From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to Washington Watch.
My name is Joseph Backholm, and I am sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday afternoon, evening. So glad that you have joined us on a week, in a week of great significance for our country. And it is a it's a strange mood, depending on where you are. And the developments of this week have a lot of people asking questions. There seems to be a lot of sadness, a lot of melancholy. What ought we think about what we're dealing with right now? And also, where can we find some hope? And that is always our goal, of course, on Washington Watch, to help you keep your eyes on the prize, to keep your eyes on eternity, and also make sure that we don't despair, because the world is broken, but God is not broken, and he is very much in charge of the affairs of men, and we can have great hope in that, even when things are happening that we don't necessarily understand. But we do have a great program to kind of break this down for you. What happened on Wednesday? That's the news of the week, of the hour. What happened at the Capitol? Was it an insurrection? Was it something else? Was it something in between? We're going to talk to a couple people who were actually there on Wednesday and kind of give the on-the-ground eyewitness perspective of people who were just there to have a say, to have their voice be heard, to pray for our country, to support the president. What was their perspective? We'll talk about that. We're also going to talk about a great HHS rule for religious freedom that was finalized. It's actually been years in the making. Was finalized just this week. It won't get a lot of attention, but it should, because it's good for people who care about religious freedom. Then we are going to talk to Pastor Jacob Ray Ohm. You may have heard the story of the elder board, the entire elder board of a church in Ontario that has had charges pressed against them because, drum roll please, they were hosting church services. And the Ontario police have decided that that was not appropriate, and they have actually brought charges not against just a pastor, but the entire elder board of this church. And we are going to talk to Pastor Jacob Ray Ohm about that. And then at the end of the hour, we are going to talk to Dr. Glenn Sunshine, who is a historian who has written a great book on called Slaying Leviathan, about the threats to religious freedom we are dealing with right now. And he's going to provide some historical context to what we're going through in America right now as Christians, and help us think through all of that. So stay tuned. It's going to be a great way to end your week. And we are going to give you some hope, because that's what we do, because we love Jesus. So let's talk about Wednesday. Let's talk about the events on the Mall in Washington, D.C. We have a couple people who were there, who are going to share their perspective and see if their perspective is any different than what you're perhaps seeing on television or on your favorite news site. And to do that, we're going to bring in first Dr. Mark Plaster. Dr. Plaster, thank you so much for joining us today on Washington Watch.
Hey, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
Well, would you just introduce yourself briefly, who you are, where you're from, and how it is that you came to be in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday?
Okay. I live slightly south of Annapolis, Maryland. I am an emergency physician and former Navy Reserve doctor with a couple of combat tours in Iraq with the Marine Corps. I ran for Congress in the last cycle with President Trump on the ticket. I have to say that I wasn't a supporter of his in the primaries, and really he had to prove himself to me in the four years of his presidential cycle, which he did. I thought that he was going to be just a New York liberal parading as a conservative, and the facts on the ground that I saw over the last 4 years convinced me that he's a true American and a true patriot. Despite some of the rhetoric that he seemed to engage in from time to time, and so I support him. I support him more actually in 2020 than I did as a candidate in 2016. I kind of held my nose and voted for him in 2016, and I campaigned for him this cycle. So when I saw the results of the election, the statistical anomalies, it really did not smell right. I mean, how could a cardboard candidate like Joe Biden end up with more votes and even Obama. And then even if you make the statement that it was a massive repudiation of Trump, how could Gallup turn around the next week and say that he was the most admired man in the country, even over Obama? And Biden only scored like 13%. So sure. It just didn't feel right, you know. I saw a lot of what evidence that was emerging. It looked like a fraudulent election to anybody with a common sense and an open mind.
Well, I know a lot of people. I know a lot of people feel the way that you do, and that's why you came to be on the mall on Wednesday. Yeah. Were you there for the president's speech at the rally?
I was. We got down there around 7 a.m. and started making our way through the security system, which took several hours. You couldn't take a backpack in. You couldn't take anything into the area where the president was speaking. So there were tons of American flags, tons of Trump flags, very patriotic. We met people from literally all over the country. Met a woman who had flown in from Hawaii, a couple had driven in from Michigan, Chicago, San Diego, and the overwhelming sentiment of everybody I met was they were kind and courteous. I mean, they weren't even bumping into you in the crowds. If you stepped on somebody's heel, or if they stepped on your heel, they were apologizing.
Sure,
you know, it was that kind of a crowd. Now, there were literally I've been to several, been to a lot of pro-life rallies. I've been to a lot of, like the prayer on the mall, that type of thing that in which I could get a feel for the size of the crowd. And I guessed there had to be probably a minimum of 400,000 people there. Obviously, I didn't meet them all.
Yeah,
of
course.
The ones that I met randomly were really fine folk.
What was your sense of the mood? Because we know what we've seen. Did you have any sense that this crowd was agitated? That anything was gonna come like what we saw later in the afternoon?
No, I didn't get that feeling at all. And in fact, a couple different times, you know, people tried to break in to lock her up. He mentioned Hillary, and they tried to break in to lock her up. Nobody was buying it. They weren't shouting it. They weren't picking it up. There was a lot of, USA, USA. There was, I would say, almost a little bit of a diminished mood there. When he finally got up to speak, there was this feeling of a momentous occasion. Mm-hmm. He started talking about that he felt that he had won by landslide. And I think that a lot of people in their gut – saw the numbers that Joe Biden was putting up, and they just didn't seem realistic. And you put up the numbers that Donald Trump did, and according to a lot of his rallies and the enthusiasm across the country, that was completely believable. And so in your spirit, you just thought, this is fraud. And the evidence that was coming out would suggest that it was fraud. So people were there. They were there to support Trump. But really and truly, you got the feeling that they were there for to make sure that we had a true election.
Dr. Plaster, I really appreciate that perspective. And because so many of us, most of us, of course, in the audience were not there. And that would include me. Thank you for sharing that. And I know that you weren't actually at the Capitol when that happened. And so we are going to bring in for our next guest somebody who Sharon Helton, who's actually the director of events at FRC, who took the day off to be part of this event as well because she was curious to see what was going to happen. And she was actually at the Capitol when the events that we've seen on the news started happening. Sharon, thanks for taking some time and being with us today.
Hi, Joseph. How are you?
I am well, and I'm glad that you are well, and I'm eager to hear your perspective about what took you to the rally on Wednesday to down to the mall and what you saw.
Well, what took me to the rally was I Love America, of course, and a friend and I had just decided we wanted to go a couple of days before just to say that we love our country. We knew it was a historic event, and we wanted to be there, and we wanted to support our president.
And
so,
And what did you perceive as was the mood of the crowd when you got there and what you saw throughout the day?
Okay, well, we actually stayed downtown at the Hyatt Regency on Capitol Hill. So we walked 15 blocks from the Hyatt to the Ellipse. And so there was a lot of time to observe people. There was a lot of time to meet people.
And for those who don't know, let me break in. For those who don't know Washington, D.C. well, the Ellipse is in front of the White House, and it is not close necessarily to the Capitol. And so she walked a long way through town, and then they walked back the other way toward the Capitol. But keep going, Sharon.
Absolutely, yes. So what I observed were a lot of everyone, patriotic, flag-waving, freedom-loving people. That were just there were African Americans, there were whites, there were Hispanics, there were Asians. There were a lot of Asians handing out in the Chinese Communist Party that we noticed. They were handing out brochures about that. Just a very patriotic, upbeat crowd. Lots of USA chants, as your former guest said.
Yeah.
And as I was walking, I did ask a couple of people, because I'm curious, why are people there? I knew why I was there, but I wanted to know why other people were there. And the concern over the election and the irregularities, obviously, and that our fundamental freedoms were being usurped, and obviously to support the president.
Sharon,
but
at
I think
point,
the election integrity.
At what point did you realize that unusual things were happening?
Well, that was once I got to the Capitol, because I can tell you, down at the Ellipse, and there were easily, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people there. And I got that from the guy who actually has been to 125 rallies that has the truck that holds the Jumbotron. And he told me, he said, I would estimate at least 500,000 people here. And so the bottom line, down at the Ellipse, it was packed. It was, you know, people just all over the place. And the mood was, again, upbeat. People were friendly. They were not being they were being very gracious to one another. So when we started walking after the president spoke, and I would say I had no idea that he, in my mind, had not said anything that was inciting any kind of violence. So I didn't even know that until later that afternoon. But when we started walking to the Capitol, and it was the same thing, very patriotic, upbeat. When we got to the Capitol,
keep going, finish, Joseph, but we are running out of time.
Yeah. When we got to the Capitol, the main thing that I noticed, the big thing that I noticed was I did not see Capitol Police. And because we do events at the Capitol, I was surprised not to see Capitol Police anywhere around.
Sharon,
and I know they're uniformed.
Yeah, I do have to cut you off because we're at a break here, and I'm sorry that we're running out of time because I would love to get the rest of your story. But the point is that this did come out of nowhere, and the vast majority of people who were there were very well behaved and were doing exactly what they should have been doing. And now, as they say, we know the rest of the story. But we're going to keep tracking this story for you.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Hannah.
What's going on? Why so gloomy?
Well, I'm a little disappointed. I had a lot planned to do during the stay-at-home time, and I just didn't do it.
Oh, yeah? What did you have planned that you didn't get to do?
Well, I was actually hoping I would finally be able to get time to do a regular Bible reading routine, and I started a couple of times. I just didn't stick with it.
Don't be too down on yourself. Starting a new routine can be hard, but one way to help is to join in with others and to have a good game plan. I think I have a good solution for you.
Oh, yeah?
Tony Perkins and FRC are doing a 2-year study in the Word. They have it all mapped out.
When did they start? I would be so far behind.
Oh, that's not a problem. You can literally jump in anytime. There's a daily reading, just a couple of chapters a day, with questions to help you think about what you're reading.
Nice. Where can I find this?
Go to frc.org/Bible, and you can get started.
Where's that again?
frc.org/Bible.
Got it. Checking it out now.
In a recent poll,
it was revealed that only 6% of Americans hold a biblical worldview. This research also indicated that Christianity's teachings on abortion, marriage, and homosexuality are not only misunderstood, but seen as dangerous and subversive. In response to this trend, Family Research Council has released a new set of resources in our Biblical Worldview series. In addition to our full publications, which cover the topics of Christian political engagement, abortion, religious liberty, and human sexuality, FRC now offers helpful summaries of each publication in this series, as well as accompanying prayer guides to help you and your family pray through these important issues. And finally, our popular Biblical Principles for Political Engagement is now available in Spanish. All these resources are free and available at frc.org/worldview. Again, that's frc.org/worldview.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Joseph Backholm here, sitting in for Tony Perkins as we break down the events of this most significant week. It seems like we've already had 2020 again here in 2021, doesn't it? But we are going to bring you some good news because we all need that. And here to do that with us is the lovely and gracious Mary Beth Waddle. She's an attorney. She's the senior legislative assistant at Family Research Council. Mary Beth, thanks for taking some time to be with us.
Thank you, Joseph. Appreciate that introduction.
Well, we appreciate you so much, and we appreciate you today because you're going to bring us some good news. Tell us what happened at HHS that we can be excited about this week.
Yes, this is absolutely wonderful news. So HHS finalized a rule today that undoes one of the terrible things from the previous administration, where any grantee of any HHS grant would be required to accept sexual orientation and gender identity ideology if they were going to be able to get a grant.
It's and kind of idolatry as well, but it's also ideology.
Yes, but that has now been reversed, which is great news because we've seen this regulation just really used to harm even innocent children.
Give us an example of one of these grantees. How would this apply in the real world for those of us who aren't frequently applying for federal grants? What kind of organizations, what kind of entities are we talking about that this would apply to?
One of the entities that you're talking about, as I was just mentioning with the most needy children out there, is faith-based adoption and foster care agencies. In Massachusetts, Illinois, Michigan, San Francisco, D.C., Philadelphia, even my own home state of South Carolina, all of these places have attempted to get rid of or strong-arm faith-based adoption providers because of their faith and their religious beliefs. And we need all hands on deck when it comes to helping these needy children. In my home state of South Carolina, Miracle Hill Ministries, they were directly threatened, with potentially losing all of their funding and their ability to work with the government in this space. But fortunately, Senator Tim Scott and some others and some of the delegation over in the House, they stood up and HHS was able to grant a waiver while they were in the process of finalizing this rule that they just did.
Do you have a sense for how much money, how many grants this applies to?
Well, this would apply to any and all grants because the rule that was put in by the previous administration that was changed applied to any and all grants. So any money, any grantee, if they were faith-based, if they had a religious conviction to use this grant money to help their communities, they either had to be willing to capitulate on that or forfeit it altogether if they wanted to get money. All HHS money was tied to an acceptance of sexual orientation and gender identity, and that is now this rule undoes that.
And just to provide some context for HHS, as I talked to somebody who works in the agency recently under the current administration, who pointed out that if HHS were its own country, it would have just the budget of HHS. It would be like the fifth or sixth largest GDP of in the world. It is a massive, it's just an agency within the U.S. government, but it is really big, and we're not talking small amounts of money that this would apply to. Now,
absolutely not at all. I think a quarter or something around there of our economy is healthcare.
Right. And it covers, so it's a big agency, just so people understand what this applies to. Now, you mentioned that this rule has reversed a rule from the previous administration. Can you tell us why that rule was put into place in the first place?
The ideology. The previous administration repeatedly tried to force its agenda, its ideology, on those of faith, and had multiple instances of where they just showed a lack of wanting to have a lacking of understanding of the First Amendment and what it really means to have religious freedom and religious liberty, and then ultimately, as I mentioned, how it's not just about religious liberty, how that affects the most needy in our communities where a lot of this health money is going and being used.
Right. And just I think it's important for people to kind of understand the context of this and why this is so important, because it feels regulatory and it feels kind of legal. But what this meant is for, adoption agencies, churches, social service providers, people who are just trying to serve their community, that the government was taking a position that in unless you embrace a certain value system, and really what is functionally in every practical way a religion, its own set of ideas, which of course in America you're free to have these beliefs, but the bedrock principle of religious freedom that America has embraced in its First Amendment is the idea that the government is not going to punish you because of your beliefs. But what this rule did was specifically say, and unless you affirm a certain view of gender, unless you affirm a certain view of sexuality, you and your religious organization or your nonprofit organization are disqualified, or even your for-profit organization, they could get grants in some cases. You are disqualified unless you are willing to abide by a certain set of values that conflict with the majority of religious instructions on the planet. So I think it's important to understand where this came from and why it is a threat. Now, Mary Beth, we know that we're about to see an administration change. If this was a rule change from the previous administration, what do we project moving forward to the Biden administration?
Oh, they'll try to go back to the way it was under the Obama and Biden administration. They'll do what they can to undo this and put it back to the way it was.
Yet another reminder of why elections matter. Mary Beth, thank you so much for joining us, for bringing this, and thank you for your work on this as well, because I know it is significant. And thank you for joining us today. And folks, on the other side, stay with us, because we're going to talk to Pastor Jacob Rayome from Trinity Bible Chapel in Ontario, Canada, and he's going to tell us about the charges that have been brought against his church for simply holding church services. You don't want to miss it.
The history of religious persecution in China is extensive, and many are not aware of the current oppression of religious groups taking place there. China restricts religious practice and oppresses religious minorities on a sweeping scale. This religious persecution targets those of every faith. Christians, Muslims, Tibetan Buddhists, and Falun Gong practitioners are all victims of the Chinese Communist Party's efforts to suppress any set beliefs that might compete with the party's ideology. This campaign against religion has had and continues to have devastating consequences for those who simply wish to live according to their conscience. Family Research Council's recently updated publication addresses China's consistent abuses of human rights and explains why they cannot be treated like any other country. Learn more about this issue by visiting frc.org/China.
Aw, man.
What's wrong?
I just missed Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, and our congressman was going to be on the show today.
Oh, that's not a big deal.
What do you mean?
Well, you can always catch the replay of the day's show.
How's that?
With the Stand Firm app.
Yeah?
Yep, you can catch that day's program and so much more. You can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes while conveniently going about your day. You can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on the main feed, so you can stay up to date on local and national news.
Wow, I definitely use that. How do you find the app?
Just visit frc.org/app and download, or search Stand Firm in the App Store.
Okay, that's Stand Firm.
Yep, Stand Firm.
How do you know all this?
Because I'm a SageCon, but that's another story.
Huh?
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Joseph Backholm sitting in for Tony Perkins today as we discuss the news of the week and what should be, in some places, the news of the year. A story that has already happened. You may already know about it, but you may not. In Ontario, Canada, we have an entire elder board who has had charges pressed against them because they had the audacity to hold church services. No, this is not North Korea, friends. This is our friendly neighbors to the north in Canada. And here to discuss us with it, Pastor Jacob Ray Ohm. Pastor Ray Ohm, thank you so much for taking some time to be with us today.
It's my pleasure, Joseph. Thanks for having me.
Well, we are glad to have you, though we are concerned about the story. Why don't you tell us a little bit, give us a quick bio about who you are. I'm sure you didn't get into ministry looking for trouble like this, but tell us where you came from and how you came to be talking about this today.
Right. Well, when I got into ministry, I figured I'd eventually get into trouble, but I didn't know it would be over violating health protocols. I figured it would be...
Well, you are in very good company by getting in trouble, and I think you probably know
that. Yeah, I understand that. And, I mean, I figured we'd end up getting in trouble for some type of hate speech violation eventually, but I'd end up on the wrong side of the law for that. But, no, we're on the – I've been the pastor here for 11 years, and we went through the first lockdown in Ontario back in the spring. It ended second Sunday in June. And I was part of a team that was advocating for our premier of the province to get the to release the churches from this, I guess, lockdown. And he finally listened to us after some threats of lawsuits and whatnot. So we get through the summertime, and they're all talking about second lockdown around Christmas. And so we start leading the church towards the direction of what we're going to do if there is a second lockdown. And we decided that we would remain open. And so we had the audacity to keep our church, to open our church the first Sunday in January. The last Sunday in December and then the first Sunday in January. So we've now had two Sundays whereby we've been open as a church against the Orwellian legislation that's come from our premier that's called the Reopen Ontario Act that's being used to close everything down again.
Go ahead.
So I'm our elder board and our church is now, if we have to pay all the maximum of what we've been charged, we will have to pay, I think it's $11.4 million, and each do 2 years in jail.
That's the maximum penalty for violating
this. That's the maximum penalty.
Okay.
It's $11.4 million. So $10 million would go to the church, and the remainder, like the actual church corporation, and the remainder would go out of pocket.
Gotcha.
From each elder, and each elder would be liable, because it's liable up to 2 years in jail, I believe.
Incredible. At what point did you learn that you were in legal trouble?
Well, I knew we'd be in legal trouble when we decided to open the church, because two police officers visited me before we opened it. I sent a letter to the chief of police about mm-hmm. 4 days before we opened and informed him that we would be doing so, and we asked him to attend our service. We invited him because he attended the Black Lives Matter protest in downtown of our city, where there was upwards of 12 to 20,000 people who were in violation of the Ontario lockdown of 5-person gatherings outdoor maximum at that time.
Mm-hmm.
The chief of police was supportive of that vocally. There was no charges laid to my knowledge, and so I asked him to come and support our church as we gathered to honor the persecuted church around the world. Within a few hours, the next day, I had two of his officers came and visited me and informed me that we'd be in violation of the law.
So from your perspective, they are not enforcing the law equitably.
No.
Is that fair to say?
I believe it's an arbitrary application of the law. I mean, if you can have a 12 to 20,000 gathering downtown Kitchener that's not enforced, when you're only allowed to have a 5-person gathering, and then we gather at church on Sunday, and now that is enforced, and we're looking at potentially 2 years in the clink for each elder. I don't think so.
Yeah. Well, tell me what was it that motivated you to make this decision despite what the law has said?
Well, the definition of a church is it's a gathering. So it's an ekklesia. Its Greek word means to gather together. And so a church that does not gather is not a church. And the example of our Lord Jesus is, Christ came to us not in pixelated images on a computer screen. He came in the flesh. And we are to live and eat and breathe with one another and be in each other's presence. And this is a good gift of God. And we started to analyze the data of the COVID-19 pandemic and realized that the actions of our government are completely disproportionate to what's actually going on.
Now we got 1 minute left, so this will be the final question for you. But now that you're in this situation, getting some news coverage, what are you telling your church? What is your position? How are you talking and thinking about this now?
Well, the people need to keep their eyes fixed on the Lord. I mean, the last thing we need them to do is keep their eyes on the wave and then start to panic. So we keep our eyes on our Savior. He's a good Savior, and he can end this storm with one little word.
Amen. Pastor Rayom, thank you so much for taking the time, and thank you for your courage. May it be an example to many. Keep your eyes on the Lord. Thank you so much for what you're doing, and thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me. Take care now. Bye.
On the other side, we're going to talk to Dr. Glenn Sunshine. Put all of this in a little perspective historically. He's a church historian. I think you'll be encouraged. You'll learn some things as well. How unusual is what we're living through right now? On the other side, Dr. Glenn Sunshine. Be right back.
Get a trusted perspective on the news of the day every day. Listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins to get honest and in-depth commentary on what's going on in our nation's capital and around the world. Join Family Research Council President Tony Perkins live every weekday on over 800 radio stations across the country. Or listen to the show when it works for you by visiting tonyperkins.com. On the show, you'll hear from guests like Ben Carson, Senator Josh Hawley, Representative Vicki Hartzler, Molly Hemingway, Pastor Jack Hibbs, Dana Lash, Sissy Graham Lynch, Pastor John MacArthur, Eric Metaxas, Albert Moeller, and more. Tony is joined by leading political figures, pastors, and policy and culture experts who will inspire you to be engaged and informed on the important issues facing America. For a Christian perspective on the news of the day, tune in to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins at tonyperkins.com.
Ever since the Supreme Court handed down its infamous Roe v. Wade decision in 1973 that legalized abortion nationwide, a national debate has raged over whether the government should fund abortion. In 1976, Congress banned taxpayer funding of abortion and Medicaid by passing the Hyde Amendment. Several states have followed suit, passing their own restrictions on abortion funding. However, because government funding is a complex system of joint federal and state programs, completely banning taxpayer funding for abortions and abortion businesses like Planned Parenthood is challenging. There is still much work to be done to free the American taxpayer from funding the horrific practice of abortion. Family Research Council's new publication clearly explains the Hyde Amendment and why we need to keep it in order to save taxpayers from being forced to fund abortion. Access this important information by visiting frc.org/hyde.
What's on your daily or weekly reading list? Are you looking for honest and informative commentary from fellow believers on the current issues facing our culture? Family Research Council has just the thing. Check out FRC's blog at frcblog.com. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts as well as outside contributors. On our blog, you can read about a wide variety of topics, including religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture. Read up on some of our latest titles like Four Disturbing Trends in Religious Freedom Worldwide, Legitimizing Looting Jeopardizes Liberty for All, The Media Still Doesn't Get It, Conservatives Tend to Vote Conservative, and more. At Family Research Council, our mission is to advance faith, family, and freedom in the culture by helping you live out your faith and to stand for truth. Our blog is here to help you do that. Stay informed and get the resources you need at frcblog.com.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. My name is Joseph Backholm, ending the week with you in a great way as we're going to bring in Dr. Glenn Sunshine. You needed a little sunshine in your life. We're going to give you a little sunshine in your life. And not only will he bring you sunshine, he's going to bring you some important historical perspectives because he is a historian, a church historian, and he can tell us some things about this moment and put some context into this that we may not have based on our particular educational experience. Dr. Sunshine, thank you for coming on today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it is a delight to have you, and I also want people to know that the conversation that we're about to have it will happen in greater length in your new book, Slaying the Leviathan, which talks about how we are to respond to the threats to the liberty that we are currently facing in America. But you're a historian. You have a different perspective than some of us. Just tell us your high-level kind of impressions. What are we to think? How are you thinking about the events of this week?
Well, I think that we really need to begin actually with the scriptures. You know, Jesus tells us right at the start that we're to give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's, which means that Caesar has some legitimate claims on us, but he doesn't have the ultimate claim. That goes to God himself. Or we could go to Peter and John before the Sanhedrin, where they tell them we need to obey God rather than man. So that really lays the foundation for Christian thinking about resistance. What we saw in Washington wasn't that. You know, the fact of the matter is that there is no justification for the kind of violence that we saw in Washington within the Christian tradition, even though there is a place for resistance to government.
I think the debate right now that I'm hearing and seeing online really is a factual dispute about basically who started this, and there are some on the right who are saying, well, this was Antifa, and then a couple people who were lack self-control followed them. I don't know that that's necessarily the debate that you and I want to solve right now, but how ought we think about that balance, understanding that Caesar does have some claim on us, and there are things that God says you have to submit to even when you don't like it, Paul gave us those instructions when Nero was in charge of Rome, who certainly wasn't the most righteous ruler that the earth has ever seen. So it's not only submit to good government. Where is that line between what is rightful submission to the authorities and then throwing off an authority when that authority is trying to take what belongs to God?
Well, I think that that is a very, very long discussion, and there are a whole lot of different issues involved in it. You know, at the simplest level, when government tells us to do something that God forbids or forbids us from doing something that God commands, that's the obvious place where you have to draw the line. Mm-hmm. You know, if government tells us that, you know, like is happening in China right now, that we have to rewrite the scriptures to suit the Chinese Communist Party, that we need to basically treat the president as God. You know, those are kinds of things that we have to just simply say no to. But it gets much more complicated when you start asking questions about what is it that government has legitimate authority over. And within the Christian tradition, there have been a lot of answers to that question, but what it comes down to ultimately is what is it that God endowed humanity with prior to the establishment of human government? You know, when you go back to Genesis, when you look at Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, what rights did they have? Those rights predate human government, and therefore human government has no ultimate authority over them. And those traditionally have been understood in a variety of terms, but they were codified probably best by John Locke with his ideas of life, liberty, and property. Jefferson modified that to pursuit of happiness, but that's, again, another longer discussion of what he meant by that.
Sure, and of course, the references that you've just made are evidence that this discussion is not new and it is not easily solved, like many conversations we have within the church. When you see what we're dealing with, what happened on the Mall on Wednesday, the longer conversation we've been having about COVID, we just talked to a pastor from Canada who is facing charges from the government of Ontario because they are simply holding church services in a way that they say is against the law. Can we put this moment in some kind of context? Is there something that you think of that is similar to this that we can draw from?
There, you know, it's been said that history repeats itself. Actually, I don't believe that's true. It's more that historians repeat each other. we don't really have an exact parallel to this. However, the situation in Canada reminds me very much of situations that have come up in, for example, the context of the French Revolution and other places where there were bans on worship. And there were all kinds of good reasons and good excuses that people had for doing that. But ultimately, the question becomes, does God command worship? And if he does, then no human authority has the right to prohibit that.
What would you say to the idea that, well, worship can be done in all sorts of ways, and you can worship in your living room, you can worship in your car, you can worship in your office. So the government telling you not to do this is not necessarily a restriction on your freedom to worship.
Well, actually, it is. By any definition, it is a restriction. Further, when you take a look at passages like Hebrews 6, excuse me, where it says, do not forsake your assembling together,
right,
as is the habit of some, but encourage one another. We need to be in an environment in which we can do that, and that can only happen when we gather together. It's explicitly commanded there to gather together. And further, it is extraordinarily difficult to truly encourage someone over Zoom.
Well, that's a fair point, and that's a point that in the last segment that the pastor from Canada, Pastor Rayom, made. He said he doesn't think the assembling of yourselves together that we are not supposed to forsake is a pixelated version of yourselves over Zoom, and I think that's a really good point. And honestly, I think the experience that so many of us are having right now, as we are denied the fellowship that we've been used to and simply the socialization that humans are created to need, I think the loss that so many of us are feeling are evidence of the fact that God didn't just say that because, you know, he needed a way to, you know, facilitate some kind of pyramid scheme. We are made for community, and we are made to be together. And when that experience is denied to us, we are experiencing a loss, aren't we?
Well, yes, and the fact of the matter is that it's not even depending on how you're looking at it. More people are dying because of the shutdowns than are dying because of COVID.
Yes.
When you take a look at the global picture, I mean, you know, even the UN is saying it's going to be over 100 million people are going to starve to death because of this. That's many, many more than are going to die of COVID. And that doesn't include things like the suicides, deaths by opioid abuse, things like that, that are skyrocketing as a result of the government action. I think that if you're actually going to pay attention to this, even just from the limited perspective of a public health crisis, you have to take into account all aspects of it, not just one disease that has a 98% survival rate.
If a pastor came to you and sought some advice and said, hey, I understand, you know, all of the data that you've just referenced and just kind of their own experience of, you know, we wanted to help early on and nobody wants to kill the people in their church, right? So we cooperated. We're now at the point where we feel like, you know, we have to get people back together again. But let's say they're in Canada and the law still says you shouldn't. What is your advice to them? How should the church be thinking about it now?
I think that we need to stop thinking of the church in terms of necessarily large institutional structures. I would encourage pastors who may be facing the kinds of restrictions that you see in Canada to encourage people to get together in homes. Mm-hmm. Go back to a house church model, a cell church model, something like that, that keep the house churches connected to the campus church, the main church, so that when restrictions are lifted, they can come back together, but encourage people to collect for worship in homes. Going to be much, much more difficult to police that.
Yeah, correct. And so that is a way to perhaps skirt around that issue is, okay, let's take the ecclesia where we've been in this building, but let's just disperse it. Let's make sure we're gathering, doing it at homes. It's harder for the government to monitor. But on the larger question of should the government be able to tell the church you cannot gather and how should our response be, in your judgment, does that fall on the side of the submission to the proper authority of government that we just have to comply with because they're the rulers that God has given us? Or does that fall in the line of they are trying to interfere with things that are directly in conflict with what God has told us?
I would say it's the latter. They are usurping authority that belongs to God. It is one thing if the church leadership says, we don't believe it's safe to worship. You know, mm-hmm. we don't believe it's safe for us to gather together for the duration of this emergency. Here's how we're going to deal with the pastoral needs that are going to arise within the congregation. It's one thing if the church decides that. It's a whole different thing when the government steps in and does that, because once the government does that, it says that we are over the church.
Right. And that to me is the big point is remembering who do we serve? And when the government tells us to do something that is in conflict with what God has told us to do, God wins every time. And for us, it's just a matter of, do we have the courage to do that? Because as the church in Canada is saying, and many others throughout the country have seen, there is a cost to doing so, isn't there?
Yes. And we shouldn't be surprised at that. Jesus, Paul, Peter, James, John, all of them told us that we're going to be facing trouble. The world is going to hate us. We're going to face opposition. Everyone who wants to live a righteous life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. They don't allow for any exceptions to that.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
We should expect opposition. We may not like it. We may not want it. We shouldn't go courting it. But we should stay faithful and just simply expect that as we do that, we're going to draw fire.
That's right. And understand that ultimately, as Ephesians 6 reminds us, that we are fighting a spiritual battle that has natural, worldly battlefields. But this is ultimately a spiritual war, in though the government action that is keeping the church from gathering, the people who are doing that aren't necessarily maliciously saying, hey, I don't want a church to gather and I'm going to get in the way. But we have to understand from a spiritual perspective where this is coming from, and God doesn't necessarily give us exemptions when the government tells you not to. But right. I have another question for you. I want to change the conversation in our last few minutes here. Is to the events of Wednesday, the outburst at the Capitol, those who kind of went stampeding through the Capitol, recognizing it was a tiny fraction of the number of people who were there, that happened. And I've seen in online chatter and things, people kind of comparing this, and I know that many people see it this way, as, well, this is basically like the revolution. We have to overthrow the tyrants. How do you think through that? I don't know if it's necessarily trying to compare the fact set, but how should we think about the American Revolution? Because we're all thankful for it, but the reality was that was violence against a government that they determined to be oppressive, and we have been the beneficiaries of that ever since. Was the American Revolution unbiblical?
Well, again, it's difficult to justify the American Revolution on the grounds of the simple way most Christians approach Scripture. You can't really look at it and find a verse to support it. You might be able to look at the book of Judges, but even that is a bit of a strain. However, when you understand that biblical thinking involves more than just proof texting, more than just identifying a passage to justify what you're doing, when you think about it in terms of what are the implications of what Scripture says for human rights, for the responsibilities of government to citizens and citizens to government, when you look at it from that broader perspective, which is what I really try to unpack in part in my book, which is way too short to do justice to the whole topic, frankly, you can make a very good case that even though there is no proof text for the American Revolution, the British government had turned tyrannical and therefore had violated its covenant with the people. And under those circumstances, when the government violates its covenant, when it violates its legitimate authority and oversteps its bounds by trampling the rights of the citizens, then I think you can make a good case that Locke is right, that we have the right, and Locke would actually go further and say the duty, at least some Locke and some of his supporters would go that far, the duty to replace that government, because it has lost legitimacy by becoming tyrannical, by taking away the fundamental rights that God has granted to people.
Dr. Sunshine, thank you so much. These are deep, complex issues, and we can't, of course, finalize this debate and settle this debate today, but thank you for taking your time to be with us today and help us think a little more clearly through what it is that we're living through. And thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And folks, go get his book, Slaying the Leviathan. You do want to read that. You are going to enjoy that anywhere books are sold.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.